from 90.9 WBUR. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is a special edition of Radio Boston. We're devoting this hour to a conversation about housing and gentrification. We want to look at Boston neighborhoods like Jamaica Plain, which are quickly changing.
The first big sign that there was change in JP was when the Hi-Lo supermarket became Whole Foods. And that was like kind of like a market signal.
On the show, we'll hear from tenants, landlords, and community organizers.
They're developing all over the place. Really, like, a few hundred bucks is that important for you? And because of that, families had to deal with displacement, and some of these families broke up.
And we want to hear from you about prices, gentrification, and changing neighborhoods. We'll take your calls next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. 69,000 new units of housing by 2030. That's the goal Boston has set for itself to alleviate its housing crunch and try to stabilize rents. The city's well on the road to meet this goal, almost at the halfway point, and that's ahead of schedule. Almost 16,000 of these new apartments will be set aside for low and middle-income Bostonians. But even as these new apartments come on the market, long-time, often low-income residents are being pushed out of what were once affordable neighborhoods. Today on the show, we'll hear from both landlord and real estate groups, a community nonprofit developer, and we'll get some national perspective on gentrification and housing. Also, we'll take your calls about what's happening in your neighborhood. First, we're going to start with the first in a four-part series about affordable housing in Boston. WBUR's Kainat Khan brings us this report from Eggleston Square in Jamaica Plain.
Alex Puentecapellan grew up in Lower Roxbury near Eggleston Square in the 90s and early 2000s.
I would hang out here like summer times, especially as a Latino youth. Most of my friends were in JP.
He's watching the square change, with new construction going up on Washington Street, the main drag of Dominican restaurants, barbershops, beauty salons, and auto body shops. And it's changing in other ways, too. Eggleston has long been a multiracial working-class neighborhood. In 2010, the census tract encompassing most of the square switched from majority-minority to majority-white. The median household income increased. In 2000, it was just under $40,000. Now it's almost $70,000. A third of households have incomes over $100,000.
The first big sign that there was change in JP was when the Hi-Lo supermarket became Whole Foods. And that was like kind of like a market signal, like, hey guys, the coast is clear, come on down.
To explain some of what's happening, we have to back up to the 1930s. Eggleston was once a redlined neighborhood. It was deemed a risky investment because immigrants and people of color lived there. So for decades, the federal government didn't underwrite home mortgages and loans there. It led to a self-fulfilling prophecy of distressed properties and blight. In 1960, two out of every five housing units were considered deteriorated or dilapidated. By a cruel irony, the decades of disinvestment in Eggleston have made it a good investment now. Inexpensive buildings are bought and flipped to cater to higher-income residents.
And now we're greenlighting development, and we don't care what happens to the residents that live here.
Neighborhoods that once had the lowest housing prices have seen them rise at a far greater rate than the rest of the city. For example, the median cost of housing in Roxbury rose 70% from 2010 to 2015, compared with the rest of Boston, where the median price of housing rose 36%. Puentecapellan is now a community organizer at City Life Vida Urbana. He's taking me to one of these flipped apartment buildings.
So, this house, it has six apartments, and the landlord came, bought the building, and immediately gave everybody rent increases, which most of the families there couldn't afford.
We arrive at a triple-decker which looks recently painted. When it was purchased, the building had significant maintenance issues. A nonprofit had made an informal offer, seeking to fix up the building and keep the tenants housed without significantly raising the rent. But a corporate landlord had the winning bid and made improvements, including a new roof and modern appliances. The tenants had been paying between $800 and $900 for rent. The company proposed $1,350, although it said the fair market rent was $2,300. A year-long negotiation commenced, after which the company sued. All the tenants eventually agreed to move out.
The folks here had been negotiating for so long. I know this company owns a bunch of property. They're developing all over the place. Really, like, a few hundred bucks is that important for you? And because of that, a few families had to deal with displacement, and some of these families broke up.
My first house is the red one and orange one right there on the corner. And then, well, my first JP house, I should say.
Eric Harrett moved to Eggleston Square in 2011. He's a software developer who was drawn to the neighborhood for its proximity to the Orange Line and for its diversity. He's also watching it change.
The neighborhood is getting a lot richer and a lot whiter. And to me, that is the kind of neighborhood change that makes me very nervous and afraid. By the time I have kids, there won't be a place like JP for them to live in.
When you first moved here, did you worry that you were a gentrifier?
Every day. I don't just worry about it. I know that I am. But, you know, the way I think about it, there is not really anywhere you can move to where you're not going to be having that effect. You know, I think most people will try to live in the neighborhood that meets their housing needs. And, you know, as long as we're not building, you're going to be displacing somebody in that process.
Harrett cares about displacement. For him, the only way longtime residents and new higher-income arrivals like himself can both live in JP is if there is more housing. The theory that building new housing will address affordability is called downward filtering, and it's the approach Boston is taking. The assumption is that rents are rising because there's a housing shortage, and that means low-income and high-income households are competing for the same limited housing. Creating new market-rate units meets the demand from high-income households. They'll rent or buy these new apartments, freeing up the older housing stock for lower-income households. But the solution is not so straightforward.
You know, it can take quite a while for downward filtering to really have an effect on the market.
Chris Herbert is the managing director of Harvard's Joint Center on Housing Studies. He says downward filtering can take years. In the meantime, rents rise and plateau at a higher level. The issue becomes how to maintain a neighborhood with a mix of incomes while all of this, gentrification, displacement, downward filtering, is unfolding.
Income segregation is a powerful force. What you have to do to counter that is to take positive, affirmative steps to create housing that is affordable across the spectrum, that you don't just leave that to the market.
Basically, Herbert says, increasing the supply of market-rate units alone isn't going to solve the housing crisis. There have to be active efforts to build and preserve affordable housing for a range of incomes.
So let's see. As we come around the corner here...
That's Eric Harrett again, the software developer. We're in the heart of Eggleston Square, facing a development known as 3200 Washington. It stands out from its neighbors of triple-deckers. It has six stories and takes up the width of a block. Harrett supports buildings like this. He's part of a movement called YIMBY, Yes in My Backyard. It promotes higher density buildings in neighborhoods, especially along transit lines.
The real mission of YIMBY is to make it so that instead of renovating all of these old naturally affordable apartments, we have people moving into new buildings like 3200 Washington.
Harrett wants policies that would incentivize building new apartments on land that isn't used for housing, such as formerly industrial land. 3200 Washington is also how Alex Pontecapellan, the City Life organizer, became involved in housing issues in Jamaica Plain. He was part of a group that protested on the proposed site, demanding more affordable housing. It was back in 2015, when the neighborhood was being rezoned to promote more development.
You know, we were out there for a few days in tents, and, like, neighbors would honk their horns as they drove by, brought us coffee and, like, donuts and stuff, hung out with us for a little bit.
After more conversations with community groups, the developers of 3200 Washington agreed to build and set aside 18 affordable units, more than the initial proposal. And after years of negotiations over the rezoning, the city agreed to set a goal that 40% of new construction be affordable housing. To meet that goal and other affordability and anti-displacement goals across Boston, the city leverages the same market forces that are disrupting neighborhoods.
That's WBUR's Kainat Khan, and all this week she's reporting for us on affordable housing in Boston. She joins us in studio. Hi there.
Hi, Deb.
So what led you to this story?
So I have to admit that I do have some skin in this game because I live in Eggleston Square. And like Eric Harrett, who we heard from in the story, I am also very aware and I feel conflicted about my role in gentrification. But before moving to Eggleston, I lived near Jamaica Pond, and there I saw almost no development. So as soon as I moved to Eggleston, I saw a number of buildings going up or even proposals for new buildings, and I was interested in why this difference existed. And so part of it is that Eggleston was zoned for light industrial uses, so there is a lot of underutilized land there, and that is good for residential buildings. But part of it also is this long history where land was actively devalued through policymaking decisions, and that was happening for decades. And so now this neighborhood proves to be a good investment as Boston emerges again as a city people want to live in.
Hmm. And as it is with so many issues in Boston, give us just a brief outline of some of the complexities here.
Right. And so the one you hear in the story remains to me really difficult to sort out, and that was trying to assess this idea of building more. So when I was researching for this series, I read Evicted by Matthew Desmond, which is the book chronicling the lives of low-income renters in the private housing market, and he says that we aren't going to build our way out. So I think at the basic level, the argument for building more makes a lot of sense. If we're increasing in population, we need more housing. But I think what complicates this is what the scholar Duncan Kennedy, who taught at Harvard Law, writes about. And he writes that how these macro factors or assumptions play out at a neighborhood level, and it's not so straightforward. They are mediated by the neighborhood actors, and their decisions are based on what the playing field of rules is like. So if we are tenants, landlords, and developers, and the housing playing field is Eggleston Square, questions we should ask are how power is distributed and who is able to leverage and exercise their rights. So I think the conclusion I come to is sort of, as you heard Chris Herbert say, is that we just can't leave affordable housing to the market. We have to be intentional about where and how we preserve and build more affordable housing. And we need to think about how power dynamics play out.
Well, right. This is a complicated issue. There are a lot of different components here. And we're going to talk with several players involved on today's show and throughout this week. This is a four-part series. What will be happening the rest of this week?
So tomorrow we look at the city's inclusionary development policy, which requires developers to contribute to affordable housing. Either they have to build the affordable units themselves or they pay into a city fund. And then we sort of move out of the specific and take a sort of more conceptual approach to housing. So the last two stories ask why low-income people have to move to access greater educational and economic opportunities. And the last story asks whether a home is special and if it should be treated differently than other forms of property.
All right. WBUR's Kainat Khan, thanks so much.
Thanks, Deb.
Stay with us. After the break, we want you to join this conversation about housing in Greater Boston. We want to hear what's happening in your neighborhood. Are you worried about rising rents or gentrification? Have you seen it firsthand? Are you a gentrifier? Are you a landlord trying to afford the expensive Boston housing market? Give us a call. We're at 800-423-TALK. That's 800-423-8255. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. We're talking this hour about housing in Boston. As we've reported, the city has some ambitious goals to try to alleviate a housing crunch, and those include building almost 70,000 new housing units by 2030. We heard from WBUR's Kainat Khan on what housing activists call a housing and displacement crisis in the Boston area, specifically Eggleston Square. And at the state level, legislation is pending that would strengthen protections for tenants. Listeners, we want to invite you into this conversation. What's happening in your neighborhood? Are you a landlord? What's the solution to ever-increasing rents in what is now the fourth most expensive rental market in the nation? Call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. In our studio for this conversation, Richard Thall is Executive Director of the Jamaica Plain Neighborhood Development Corporation. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks, Deb.
Also with us is Douglas Quattrochi. He's executive director of Mass Landlords, a trade association for landlords in the state.
Hi, thank you. Hi.
And Greg Vassell is CEO and president of the Greater Boston Real Estate Board, a trade association that represents real estate professionals and developers. Glad to have you back.
Good afternoon.
So I want to start with you, Richard, and let's just briefly talk about some of the numbers we heard in that report about Eggleston Square. And, you know, staggering statistics, the median price of housing in Boston going up 36% between 2010 and 2015. In Roxbury, it's 70% increase during that time. So you've been there for a long time. How do you describe the changes and what the housing crunch has done to that area?
Well, I mean, this is something that's been going on for decades, but it's really been the last, as Kainat's report says, it's really been the last 10 or 12 years that there's been a tremendous uptick in the cost of housing, more and more pressure on families that have been there a long time. And one of the common things we're seeing is that folks who are in 2- and 3-family homes, if the longtime owner of that place moves out, typically then those units get condoized. So that's one pressure that is forcing some people out of the neighborhood.
So is there a lot of investor interest then in the area, would you say?
There's definitely investor interest in some of the larger vacant sites, and we have competed for some of those sites, but building affordable housing as we do, it is impossible to compete on the open market with some of those inflated prices for people who are building, primarily high-end housing.
Mm-hmm. Give me an example of sort of what costs we're talking about here. Is there an anecdote you can think of?
Well, we had looked at a long vacant parcel actually on Green Street in our neighborhood probably 4 or 5 years ago, and we looked at it very carefully, and we found out that we could probably build 30 to 40 homes, apartments for senior citizens. And our real estate folks look very carefully and work with architects and see what could we build there, what could we offer? And we felt that we could offer probably about $1 million, which is probably several times more than that site last changed hands at. And our real estate director happened to know the seller's lawyer, and when she called him, and he basically laughed and said, I see that's an earnest effort on your part, but you're not within hail. What we're going to be able to get 2 to 3 times that on the open market.
Wow. So I wonder, Greg Vassell with the Greater Boston Real Estate Board, when you hear stories like that, what would you say? What are investors looking for in these communities when they do look to invest in real estate in some communities where displacement can be an issue?
One of the problems. We face a crisis here of on the development side of costs. Our land costs have skyrocketed because we don't have enough developable land. Our building costs have skyrocketed as well. So, when you take a look at a situation like that, the difficulty is at the end of the day, when you produce a unit of housing, it's going to be at an income level that far exceeds what people in the neighborhood could possibly afford. And that's frustrating for the development community. Massachusetts as a whole has been successful at producing government-assisted affordable housing. And, of course, market-rate high-end housing is easy because the math works. Our biggest problem has been producing for working families in the middle. And it really is a case-by-case basis, project-by-project. But that's really what our focus should be, is finding a way to do that. Now, Boston passing the CPA should help be able to hit an income level that we haven't been able to reach before.
CPA, explain that.
The Community Preservation Act, which will allow some building for people that would fall into the medium working class range of incomes. But it still isn't going to be enough. And we feel the frustration as well.
I wonder, Doug Quattrochi, I'm gonna, not gonna, going
right.
to say
Quattrochi,
your name.
That's all right.
Quattrochi, thank you. What are you hearing from your members about rising rents in this city?
Well, I think the small owner perspective, and we are smaller in distribution, half our members have fewer than 6 units, is that you can't look at any given neighborhood or Eggleston Square or JP or even the city of Boston in the abstract. You have to look at it in the context of Massachusetts. It's really tightly regulated as a rental market. That's why we see so many condo conversions, because you can make 30% more short-term selling condos than you could long-term as a landlord operating rentals. And it's very difficult to build new housing. You're not allowed to put in new units without local zoning approval. In Boston in particular, you need parking spaces typically, and similar for Cambridge and Somerville. So there really wouldn't be an issue with gentrification if people in an area that was changing could easily go somewhere nearby and find affordable housing. The issue is that across the entire Commonwealth, there's just nowhere left to go.
Hmm. Richard, what do you say to that?
Well, I would say that people sometimes say, well, what can you do with, you know, how do you stop gentrification? You could not stop gentrification unless you had an entirely different, you know, system of property ownership. But I let me say a couple of things. One thing is that because of the tremendous efforts by people in these communities who fought for many years to build and preserve affordable housing, and because there's been a lot of support from the city and the state, if you look in JP, 25% of the homes are permanently affordable. So that, you know, that I think is a significant accomplishment. But there are national and international forces that are making Boston, you know, an extremely attractive city that people from more and more parts of the world want to come to, and folks have resources. And there are also people, you know, from the suburbs who are able to sell their homes and come in and who are going to have way more resources than anybody who's been living in the community a long time. And then we have, especially in some of the high-end market, the phenomenon of, you know, people who are in some cases not even living in the in some of these luxury homes that are selling for multi-million dollars, but it's really a way of sheltering their money
wealth,
from
right.
some of their wealth. Yeah.
Right. Well, we've got full lines here. Pat is calling from Watertown. Pat, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, how are you?
Good, thanks. I actually lived in JP for 10 years, and what I'm hearing anecdotally from friends of mine who are there and trying to buy or trying to, you know, change their rent situation is exactly what we're talking about. You'll go to an open house, and there will be a cash offer already, and it's often from someone who is from out of the country who is using it for a couple of years because their kid is at Northeastern or BU, and then using it as either an investment or a shelter. Are there mechanisms legally? I know that's been talked about in New York. It's an issue in the Seaport. Is there anything that can be done about it? Because it does artificially inflate the cost.
Mm, good question, Pat. I think that we're going to ask Greg about that. Greg, what do we do about it? I know there was a study not too long ago showing that there were a large number of luxury units in Boston that people weren't actually living in. So we've heard about this over and over again. What can be done about something like that? Or should we just leave it to the market?
Well, the difficulty is, I mean, and I think what Pat was talking about here was not necessarily the luxury unit that you'd see at Millennium Tower, the old Filene site in downtown Boston. Vancouver, I believe, passed something like this and then has regretted it, because what it does is it helps sort of quell that money that comes in. If you had people that were competing for units that people were actually, you know, working class people were going to live in, that's a different story. Mm-hmm. But I think what we're looking at here is really something that's different.
What Vancouver, explain what happened there.
But from what I understand is Vancouver passed a law that prevented foreign people to come in and buy and to live in, not live in units, but just to invest and purchase. Mm. You know, and I think if we want, my biggest question is, what do we want to be in Boston? I mean, what are we? Are we an international city? Are we Boston of the circus 60s, 70s, and 80s. Once we realize what our identity is, if we're going to be open to the world, how do we tell people they can't come here or mm-hmm. spend their money here?
Right.
I think that's sort of not the way we should go.
But what do we do to try to make sure that it's affordable for a wide variety of people? Do we leave it to the market? Will the market sort itself out? Or do we need policy changes to make sure that there's more diversity in our community?
My guess would be that if you're building a building that you would already be captured by the inclusionary zoning policy for the city, to have a number of affordable units already in that building to begin with. If a family, for example, came over, now a few years ago, there were many people coming over from China who were buying a lot of real estate. The Chinese government cracked down and made it harder for them to get their money out to come here and to purchase properties. Mm-hmm. So I think some of those countries don't want to see their citizens coming here and investing here because they don't want that money outflowing to some other place in the world.
Right. So are the policies that we have now sufficient, do you think?
Well, for foreign investors?
No, just for affordable housing. What do we need to do in the general question of affordable housing? A foreign investment is one thing, and that's an issue. But what about generally speaking? What do we do?
One of the things I think we need to do is take a look at how we build our housing. I think in Europe, there's been techniques that for building buildings that have been more successful and more cost effective than what we've done here. Mm-hmm. I've seen a lot of brochures and pamphlets from places like Spain and Portugal where they can put up buildings that are really wonderful units at much lower prices than we do here. Boston's also a union city. The rates for a union job in Boston are quite high. You know, that also affects our bottom line and what we can actually rent or sell those units for people to.
Right.
So I think we really need to take a good hard look at that.
Mm. Doug, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think the question, should we let the market handle it, it might be slightly misleading. We've managed to create a lot of housing over the last couple centuries. Just look at any picture of what JP looked like when it was first settled by Boston Puritans, right? It doesn't look anything close to what it does today. And it's been recently a lot of restrictions, particularly with respect to zoning and preventing subdivision, that have really created this shortage of housing or this inability to produce. Minneapolis announced this plan in December, Minneapolis 2040, where they said, look, if you own a lot anywhere in the city, you're going to be allowed as of right to subdivide that up to 3 units. It doesn't mean you can take away green space. It doesn't mean you can have people parking on grass. But it does mean, you know, if you can do something without changing the look of the neighborhood, having negative externalities on other people, you should be allowed to do that. I think that kind of thing in Massachusetts would go a long way toward alleviating pressure because you cannot put in rentals in the nice places where people would want to live. Hmm. They don't allow it.
Are your members at all worried about policies like rent control or rent stabilization or things that, you know, that there could be a return because of what's happening with prices? Has it gotten to that point, would you say?
Absolutely. I think people are worried about that because, first of all, it doesn't work. Second of all, it's irritating not to be invited to those discussions. Landlords have a lot of perspective on how to provide housing. And we've got a variety of different bills that we've filed, similar to what the mayor in Boston has, with different focus, same intent. For instance, the Act to Protect Elderly Tenants. Instead of capping rent increases to 5% a year, which is cold comfort for someone who's, you know, Social Security doesn't increase that much, why not extend the mass rental voucher program to people 75 and older in the form of a guarantee, where if they do fall on hard times, we've got money available to pay the rent and keep them stably housed.
So instead of a cap, use public money to help subsidize the rents if needed.
Rental subsidies are really powerful.
Yeah, go ahead.
And that's been a theme. I mean, I think it's a theme in what we've all been saying, that there are limitations to what the market can do. And given the high cost of developing, there might be some things you could do at the margins to make those costs a little more reasonable. But given what people's incomes are, and especially people who are, you know, residents in a lot of these communities and immigrants and people of color, given what the people's basic economics are and what the cost of the housing is, the market is not the only solution and can never be the only solution. And we have to look at the fact that in this Commonwealth, which historically did invest a lot in affordable housing, we went through about a 15-year period where the amount of state funding for affordable housing went down by hundreds of millions of dollars a year over about 15 years. So if you know, the cumulative effect of that is billions and billions of dollars. So to some extent, we're trying to dig out of that hole that you know, we've been trying to dig out of now since the middle 2000s.
And Deb, one of the things we forget is that because of our rent control environment up until the early 90s, we didn't produce enough for the city. Rent control would only affect our production ability because people wouldn't want to build here. I mean, it's sort of, tenants view it as sort of a victory, and but it's a fool's paradise, because the quality of those buildings is going to decline over time.
But when you hear an average of, you know, median rent of $2,400 a month, it seems like that's out of reach for a lot of folks. You know, what do you do? What do you do to help people to make sure that you have a city that is diverse?
You need some kind of subsidy to help.
A government subsidy.
You need some kind of a government subsidy, whether it be property tax breaks or something.
You also need a more liberal market. We claim that the market isn't working, but if you look at it, as I indicated with zoning, it's not possible for people to find an opportunity, and perhaps it's a little underdeveloped, and add in a new basement or attic unit. I think it's important to recognize as well that real estate is the primary leg up for a lot of people, a lot of families looking to save or make a little extra. All you have to do is buy a little more house than you need. It's the only business you can start where you can borrow up to 97% from the bank and the federal government. You don't need any formal training to get into it. It's a huge opportunity for people. And I think that's often overlooked. When we talk about real estate, we assume it's large corporations. There are a lot of small mom and pops who want to operate good quality rentals, and they're not being allowed to. They're not being allowed to create that rental housing because of zoning boards and other state regulations on landlord-tenant law.
And Deb, it has to be a regional solution, right, not just Boston.
Okay, I want to make sure we get some other callers in to comment on this. Amanda is calling from Quincy. Amanda, you're on the air.
Yes, I just wanted to make a comment about how gentrification is not just about money, but it's also that people end up having to leave their culture and neighborhood as well behind when they're forced out of the houses that they know.
Did you have to go through this? Did you witness this? What's your story, Amanda?
I'm actually a sociologist, and so I've researched some of the gentrification and seen how different groups, especially as the previous panelists just mentioned, about people of color and immigrants who have had to move out of their neighborhoods because other people move in and the rents go up.
Okay, thanks so much for the call, Amanda. Stacy is calling from Chelsea. Stacy, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I was calling because we in Chelsea are feeling the effects of the push out of Boston, and it's causing havoc with the long-term residents, many of us, folks of color, of immigrants, Latinos, and where are we going to go from here? Luckily, we have a really good agency in Chelsea, the Green Roots of Chelsea, who are working with residents to find ways to fight back and maintain our place and our residence. But it's an ongoing fight, and it's the effect of Boston.
All right. Well, Stacy, thanks so much for the call. Stacy and Amanda both saying that communities are losing more than just money here when folks are displaced. I'm wondering, Greg, what do we do about that?
You know, the interesting thing is the Chelsea example you could see coming. 7-8 years ago, it was only a matter of time, because as you look at the market, you look for land and lower land costs, and you could see Chelsea would be, you know, the perfect opportunity, the location, proximity to the city. It's right next door. You know, it's difficult. I mean, neighborhoods change. The south end of the 70s and 80s is wildly different than it is today. I would think it'd be hard for people to say that that environment was better than what we have today. But, I mean, it's difficult. It's part of our evolutionary process in real estate. Things change over time.
Okay. We're going to have to take a break. Listeners, stay with us. We'll take your calls on this. Tell us what's happening in your neighborhood. Are you worried about gentrification? Are you a landlord? Do you have an idea to help solve the housing crunch in Boston? Give us a call at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to a special hour of Radio Boston. We're talking about housing. I'm Deborah Becker. By some measures, Boston has some of the highest rents in the country, just behind San Francisco, New York, and San Jose, according to the real estate site Zumper. It lists the median one-bedroom rent in Boston at just over $2,400 a month. So many neighborhoods are becoming unaffordable for the people who currently live there. And listeners, we want to invite you into this conversation. What's happening in your neighborhood? Are you worried about gentrification? Are you a landlord? Call us at 800-423-8255. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Again, with us in studio, Richard Thall, Executive Director of the Jamaica Plain Neighborhood Development Corporation. Thanks again.
Thank you, Deb.
Douglas Quattrochi is Executive Director of Mass Landlords, which is a trade association for landlords.
Thank you, Doug.
And also Greg Vassell's with us. He's CEO and President of the Greater Boston Real Estate Board, which is a trade association representing real estate professionals and developers. Thank you. So just before the break, we were talking about housing and rents and developments and possible solutions. And I want to get a bit of a national perspective here. I know that we had mentioned Vancouver, and we had mentioned foreign investment, but there are other cities that are struggling with this all over the world, and particularly cities in the U.S. So Peter Moskowitz is a journalist and author of the book called How to Kill a City, Gentrification, Inequality, and the Fight for the Neighborhood. And he's joining us on the line from WWNO in New Orleans. Welcome to Radio Boston, Peter.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So you've been listening to our conversation, and what's your take here in terms of what you're hearing from our listeners and what you're hearing from our guests regarding affordable housing in Boston?
Sure. So I'm hearing two things that I hear often, two very separate and dissimilar perspectives. From your callers, I'm hearing a lot of concerns about the effects of gentrification, about not being able to afford to live in their neighborhoods or even their city anymore. And then from at least two of your guests, I've heard a lot of what I would call landlord propaganda, which is this idea that, you know, that landlords are really struggling too, that the market is the only way forward, that this is an insolvable situation, that it's inevitable that neighborhoods change in this specific way, that if you look at every other city around the world, it's happening over and over and over again, and there's nothing that can be done except to build more housing. And I would just like to say that that's simply not true. That's the way things currently operate in Boston and in most other U.S. cities, unfortunately. But it's really just not true. We're not going to solve this problem by, quote unquote, leaving it to the market. And that there is another rumor that I would just like to dispel. There's no such thing as leaving it to the market. We don't have a free housing market right now. We have a housing market that is skewed to favor profit for developers and favor profit for homeowners over renters and other low-income people. So there's no free markets that we're giving tax incentives to developers, to large corporations. We're zoning in ways that make housing more expensive and enrich developers as opposed to making housing more affordable. So I would just like to dispel that rumor right off the bat. I don't think we're in a free market. We're in a market that is purposefully squeezing people to profit certain people.
So I want to make sure that our folks in studio get to respond to what you're saying here. I get it that you're saying that bigger policy changes are needed to try to include everyone. But landlord propaganda, I wonder, I'd like both Greg and Doug to talk about that a little bit. Doug.
Sure. Yeah. Well, so I think there is a lot of credence to the idea that government intervention in the market has created the current system. I'll give you a for instance. Nonprofits pay no real estate tax, but municipalities still have the same operating budgets and ever-increasing needs to help local residents. So where do they get that from? They have to raise taxes on the for-profit entities operating in the city. I think it's interesting that so many renter advocates propose nonprofits should be given all these breaks from regulation and nonprofits should be encouraged to buy housing. But nonprofits are not supporting the communities they're in, with a few exceptions. We've got payment in lieu of taxes. It's definitely the case that Massachusetts landlords, small mom and pops, who want to operate successfully and take their own management fee and make a living, save for their kids' education, save for retirement, are better off forming nonprofits to buy and hold their real estate because they'll be exempt from that, one of the three biggest expenses. And for everyone else who's operating for profit, yeah, taxes, insurance, and mortgage interest are your three big expenses. So when real estate taxes rise, rents rise.
Hmm. Peter? Wait. Hold on. Richard wants to, weigh in here.
Just rebut the idea that nonprofits don't pay real estate taxes because, in fact, when I think of our housing portfolio, which is under management, we probably have about 600 units now, and I bet that with that portfolio is probably generating about $600,000 a year in property taxes that we do have to pay, and we are the proud owners and longtime developers over generations of the Brewery Small Business Complex in JP, and it's a nonprofit entity that owns that, and we're paying over $300,000 a year in property taxes. And I have to say, I'm proud that we can pay that because there are costs that we all need to contribute to, and that project is able to. So.
Is there something to Doug's point, and I want to ask Peter this, is there something to Doug's point here that, you know, landlords have to make money and it needs to be attractive for folks to go in and improve neighborhoods, not necessarily make them sort of tony or anything like that, but maybe take an unsafe neighborhood, a blighted neighborhood, and make it safe again. And the way you're going to attract that is by making it profitable. So what's the way to balance here? Peter, your thoughts?
Yeah, so I mean, I do think that there is some validity to that point in terms of, you know, landlords do need to make a profit. That's what they do. You know, McDonald's doesn't sell burgers at a loss because they're a friendly company that, you know, wants to just give everyone burgers. Businesses exist to make money, right? Mm-hmm. So in a way, I think the buck doesn't stop with landlords. It really stops with the government, which is allowing landlords to make ridiculous profits and have a huge influence on city politics. I mean, if you look at the main donors to most city politicians across the country right now, who are they? They're landlords, they're investment corporations. Even Bill de Blasio in New York City, who campaigned on quote unquote ending the tale of two cities and fixing gentrification in New York. Every single one of his main funders is from the real estate industry, and he hired Alicia Glenn from Goldman Sachs' real estate division to head his housing development policy. Mm-hmm. So we've kind of really infected the government with this market economy philosophy. So in a way, I don't blame landlords. They're doing their job. They're trying to make a profit, but the buck needs to stop somewhere, and that needs to stop at the law that could enable people to live affordably, or the variety of laws that could.
Okay, I want to make sure we get some callers in here. Rob is calling from the South End. Rob, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for having me. I think my point could probably be best summed up to respond to that last comment, where somehow the government should cap profits on developers. I don't even really understand that. And I think that's kind of the point that I was calling in for. Maybe the government should, rather than trying to hold down neighborhoods, maybe the government should be focused on lifting up neighborhoods that are affordable, like public transportation, for instance. Maybe it wouldn't be such a big deal to get into Boston from the north or from the west or from wherever if the public transportation were better. Hmm. Rather than trying to keep the South End down or the East Boston down or whatever, and I know when I say keep it down, it sort of sounds loaded, but it's not meant to. What you are talking about doing is making an effort to try to limit the upside. And I'm not really sure I understand why you would think that would profit anybody. Hmm. That doesn't benefit anybody.
But government, what you're saying here, though, is government policies are definitely needed.
Yeah, I mean, I think...
Peter, go ahead.
Yeah, so I don't see why you can't do one and the other at the same time. I'm not talking about not allowing anyone to make a profit. You know, your guests have said that rent regulation simply doesn't work, but every major European city has rent regulation. In Shanghai and Hong Kong, which are, you know, not communist economies at all, 50% of all new housing has public funding behind it in order to maintain the city's affordability. In Berlin, which is a booming city, tons of people are moving there right now. There's a new law on the books that apartments cannot be rented above 10% of what they were rented at for a new tenant, which essentially de-incentivizes evictions. And you don't see people stopping building in Berlin or Paris or Shanghai or really anywhere else. So this idea that regulation is going to stop building to me is frankly just factually inaccurate. Mm-hmm. But that being said, I think your caller has a point that there's another side to this. The city governments across the United States have really stopped investing in equitable forms of government, whether that's public transit or public housing or even road repairs, public schools. All of these things contribute to gentrification in the sense that when you only have, let's say, 5 subway stops that are close to downtown Boston or even 50 subway stops that are close to downtown Boston, you essentially concentrate amenities so that everyone has to go and compete over them. And that obviously ends up favoring whoever has the most money to compete for that asset and pushing people who can't afford to compete for it out further and further where there isn't public transit or good public schools or what have you. Mm-hmm. So I think it really has to be both. There has to be regulation, which, as I said, works the world over. And there also has to be more public investment from the city, from the state, and from the federal government.
I want to get another caller in here. Maddie is calling from Attleboro. Maddie, you're on the air.
Hi. I moved to D.C. to work at a nonprofit focused on ending homelessness. As I understand, housing contributes to, you know, long-term wealth and the racial inequality we have with family wealth. But I also lived in one of the most gentrified neighborhoods. So it was really bothering me that I would go to work every day hearing stories of how people needed to produce an eviction notice in order to receive, like, assistance to prevent their homelessness. But I would go home and, you know, be a gentrifier. So it made me think a lot about how, like, are our policies in a vacuum? Who is there creating these policies? Like, what kinds of social power goes into play when even thinking about the other side of the housing crisis, which is the people who are experiencing it? Hmm.
Thanks so much for the call. I wonder, just Peter, because you write about this as well, mm-hmm. Well, you're a gentrifier, right? So how yeah. do you reconcile this? You want to live, in a neighborhood that has amenities, and it gets increasingly expensive. And here you are writing about gentrification and how it's killing cities. What do you do? How are you reconciling this?
Right. Well, I think this comes to the question of individual versus kind of collective power. If you look at someone on an individual level, you know, me not to use the example of McDonald's again, I don't know why I'm obsessed with McDonald's today, but maybe I'm just hungry. But, if you decide not to eat a burger at McDonald's, will anyone notice? Probably not. If you organize a national boycott of McDonald's, will people notice? Probably. So I think the same kind of philosophy can be applied to housing. If you feel guilty as a gentrifier living in a gentrifying neighborhood in any city in the country, your individual action as one person is not really going to be enough to do anything when you're competing against, you know, the newest, biggest landlords are the Blackstone Group and Goldman Sachs and large multinational banks. So you versus them, you're not really going to have an individual action. But if we can kind of form some kind of larger collective action to have a housing-based movement in this country, which I do think you see happening in neighborhoods across the country. One of your previous callers mentioned a group in Chelsea, I guess, mm-hmm. that's doing something like that. And I think that's happening. Then we can start to actually build a base that can push for effective policy and push for effective change. But to your caller's question, what are the influencers behind this? I mean, look at the lobbying dollars spent. We always talk about the oil lobby. We talk about the bank lobby. One of the largest lobbying groups in the country, if not the largest some years, is the National Association of Realtors. And what's the last time you've heard a politician bring that up? What's the last time you've heard them challenged on any meaningful policy? Our largest housing subsidies right now go to private mortgages, right? So it's not, as I said before, it's not as if we're living in some kind of free market. We are living in a market influenced by one of the largest lobbyist groups in the country and in a market that privileges the people who have lobbied for those laws.
All right. Well, I want to let our guests comment on that a little bit. Greg, what would you say to Peter's comments?
Well, I'm amused by Peter's comments because when you take a look at the way our democratic system works, You know, yes, I mean, you have lobbying groups, but you also have tenants groups. You have other groups that are bringing in people with oxygen masks at hearings, doing sit-ins in elected officials' offices. So, no, they're not spending dollars and writing checks, but they're doing their own form of civil disobedience. You know, we had a group that picketed our office, brought in children and put them in front of our office door and taught them. They did a puppet show for them and taught them how evil landlords were. I mean, it's pretty misguided. So, you know, yes, we are a victim in this country of our own political system, whether it be, you know, financial fundraisers or the civil disobedience that the other groups use because they don't write the checks. Mm. So it's unfortunate, but that's America.
Mm. And Doug, what do you say?
Well, from the mass landlord's point of view, I don't feel like I have any influence at all. We certainly don't have any money. We don't fund campaigns. We don't make donations in that way. We've asked repeatedly to be invited to Boston City Council or the mayor's office to discuss how we can collaborate on these solutions, and we're consistently shut out. So our perspective is that a lot of these policy ideas have originated from renter advocates, and that those folks are, in fact, at least in Massachusetts, the most influential.
A big idea here, and we have very limited amount of time left, but I'm wondering, I think, Richard, you might be able to explain it for us, is should housing be treated differently? Is it a different commodity on the market? And just what would you say to that?
I would say absolutely. I mean, housing, you do not have a choice. You know, unless you are going to be out, you know, what was the famous quote about the lawn? Its majesty allows the rich man and the poor man the equal right to sleep under a bridge at night. I mean, housing is a different commodity than other things that you have an option of using them.
Hmm. All right. Well, Richard Thal, Executive Director of the Jamaica Plain Neighborhood Development Corporation.
Thank you.
Also from New Orleans, journalist and author Peter Moskowitz. Thank you, Peter.
Thank you.
Douglas Quattrochi. I got it finally right.
Perfect.
Executive Director of Mass Landlords. Thanks to you.
Thank you so much.
And Greg Vassell, CEO and President of the Greater Boston Real Estate Board. Thank you for
thank
being
you.
With us. Listeners, thanks for your calls today. We'll continue the conversation, but that's it for now. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.